It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Later in the program, we'll be joined by Joyce Brabner, author of the graphic novel Second Avenue Caper, which talks about the early days of the AIDS crisis in America. But we wanted to begin with a conversation on HIV/AIDS as it relates to some of the themes in Joyce Brabner's book, drug dealing, smuggling, AIDS medications, the whole underground that was coming up in the early days of the AIDS crisis. And in particular, in this first segment, we want to look at what was going on in Pittsburgh in the early 80s as AIDS first started to rear its ugly head. I'm joined now in studio by a couple of people who worked very closely with people during those days who were affected by HIV/AIDS. One is Dr. Charles Rinaldo. He's chairman and professor of the Department of Infectious Diseases and Microbiology at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Rinaldo, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Also with us is Alan Jones. He's a Pittsburgh AIDS Task Force worker and someone who was a caseworker here in Pittsburgh in the relatively early days of the HIV/AIDS crisis. Alan Jones, good to have you back with us. How are you?
Thank you. I'm glad to be here today.
And we'd like to invite our listeners to join our conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. What did you or people you know experience in those days back in the early 80s when we knew very little about AIDS? It was a mysterious disease. It was a devastating disease. It tore apart the gay communities in many parts of America, and only after it began to make its way into the so-called mainstream communities in our society did we start to see a serious response to the AIDS crisis. What we're going to focus on now in this conversation is those days when we didn't know a whole lot in the early 80s. We'd like to know how it impacted you and the people you knew and loved back in the early 80s. 412-246-2002 to share your stories with us. You can also join us via email at esspgh@wesa.fm and also on Twitter at esspgh. Dr. Rinaldo, when did you first hear about AIDS?
When the reports – well, actually, the first – we had a case at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center that was back in 1981. And a young male who was gay and had these mysterious diseases that we don't find in otherwise healthy people. Pneumocystis carinii pneumonia was what he had, and also a cytomegalovirus infection. And he was presented at infectious disease rounds as an interesting case, and we were baffled by what was going on here because it looked like what we were seeing in organ transplant recipients at the time who were greatly immunosuppressed so they would not reject their organs. And as a result of that, they were getting pneumocystis on occasion or CMV infections, which were similar but not quite as severe.
So this first case comes up, and how is the medical community responding to it at that time?
Really, they treated it like they would have an organ transplant, gave him certain drugs, and he died from that infection shortly thereafter. He actually was seen by the CDC. He lived long enough to go to Atlanta and be seen and was one of their first cases that they saw. But eventually he died of the disease. So there really wasn't much because Pittsburgh was a low-incidence area. You've got to realize that we have very few cases. And this was the first of just a few at the time. But that's when the reports came out soon after. Several months later, the CDC MMWR reports of the first cases in Los Angeles and New York City.
And so as we began to learn more about what this was, I imagine there was certainly in the general population, there was a great deal of fear because no one really knew. There were no drugs. There were experimental drugs, but nobody knew exactly what would treat it or at least, if not stop the effects, at least slow the effects of this disease. So was there we saw in certain parts of the country certainly some level of panic. What was it like here in Pittsburgh?
I think Alan could speak better from the street perspective. But for us, it was mainly – this was fascinating to us because something was different. This was not what we had seen before. But it had some of the earmarks of what we had seen before, like CMV, cytomegalovirus, which is what I was studying at the time in transplant recipients. So it was natural for me to ask the question, well, what was going on in these individuals that had this infection, which we normally don't see in such severe form?
And you mentioned that Pittsburgh was a low-case area. Is there anything to explain why that was?
That was a big question. That's why in 1983 we were funded by the NIH to begin the Pittman study, which we were chosen among other sites as well because we were the low incidence center. And the theory then, we didn't know what caused it in 83. So the theory then was it was an infectious agent, but could it be a different agent in Pittsburgh? And that's why we had so few cases compared to New York City. Could they have a different form of this virus or whatever it was? And so that's why we were chosen to study this. And as Chicago and Los Angeles and Baltimore, Washington area were also chosen for the high incidence areas.
So Alan Jones, you know, eventually you would work on – you would become a caseworker and you would be working with people who had AIDS. But, you know, in these early days, you know, the street perspective, as Dr. Rinaldo describes it, from that perspective, what were you seeing? What was it like?
Well, I think it was interesting. I'd come out as a gay man, you know, in the 1970s. I was going to the clubs, you know, the disco era. That was just part of my life. And it was just so funny. All of a sudden, we were reading in the paper, like in the New York Times especially. There would always be articles about this, what we call the gay plague. And I remember one of my friends, Rick, was talking about it one night. A couple of us were actually at a nightclub, and we were just talking at the table. And he said, well, what do you think about it? And I was puzzled by something because it was always being identified with gay men. And I thought, well, this is really strange to have a disease that only affects gay men. Like why – like a disease would only affect Presbyterians.
Well, right. And there were people who in those days who were going around feeling, oh, well, then I'm straight, so I'm immune to this, who really thought that way.
Exactly. And I always remember me saying to my friends, I thought it was like the Legionnaires' disease, that these gay men in New York City happened to be exposed to something, not because they were gay, but just because they were someplace, maybe a club. I didn't know, and I thought it was like, you know, what we would later know would speak of in those days as the Legionnaires' disease. But I remember mm-hmm. telling my friends, this is something we will never have to worry about, like here in Pittsburgh, only to be proven wrong in short time.
And as far as Dr. Rinaldo, why it was only affecting the gay community initially, the reason for that was what?
Well, we know because the intercourse, the highest risk factor among gay men was anal receptive intercourse, which we showed actually a few years later and published on that. But it was evident then that there were sexual practices that were likely behind this. They were spreading it amongst themselves by certain sexual practices that were more prominent in gay men than in straight men.
But eventually it became a situation where everybody was exposed to it. But in those early days, there was a lot of anger in the gay community. Talk, Alan, about the feelings that people had because there was a sense that we're being hung out to dry here. Nobody is helping us.
A really good friend of mine had a roommate who was living with AIDS. And the big dilemma was they were having a hard time getting him hospitalized. He would go into a hospital. He would lay on a gurney for literally hours, and then they would discharge him.
Why? What was going on?
They just said, well, he'd been here 3 and 4 times. And part of the problem is at this point, he had lost his insurance. So he was on medical assistance. They didn't really know what to do about it. At that time, I was working at Mayview State Hospital, and we actually had people who would not enter rooms with someone who were HIV positive or would want to put something over their tennis shoes when they entered a room. Because people – the fear was in those days, we really didn't know, or most people didn't know, how it was spread. They didn't know if it was airborne. I mean, no one had come out with any defining information on that. And I think for gay men, we already felt ostracized in those days for being gay. And then now we have a disease that's called a plague. And we weren't even so sure, did we have it? How was it spread? And then the fact that many members of our community, as I mentioned, my friend Bobby, you know, he would go in and out of the hospital, had lost a lot of weight, had survived pneumocystis pneumonia, which he later died of. So we felt pretty much ostracized. We felt like the system wasn't helping us enough.
Yeah, I think Alan's brought up a good point that I want to take off on a little bit. The fear in the streets and so forth, how it was spread. We knew in 1982 that it was not casually spread. And the CDC was already realizing this because if it was, we would have seen many different – the epidemiology of this disease would have been totally different, okay? All sorts of people getting it if it was airborne, and that was not happening. We knew within a year or so of the first cases in 81, this is not the way it's spread. It's got to be intimate contact, and we made that quite clear. And, in fact, I want to mention the there was a tavern guild that's still going of tavern owners of gay bars and bathhouses in the area that had a group already formed at that time, and they asked us to – because they were so fearful of losing, frankly, their business, because if this was casually spread, you know, if I'm going to share a glass or this glass wasn't washed as much, this shot glass or something, and I'm going to use it, maybe I'll get this mysterious thing. And so we assured them that was not the case, and they actually helped us start the Pitt Men Study because they helped us recruit the men through their services. We physically went to those places and recruited the men at those facilities at the time.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about the early days of the AIDS crisis. It's been some 3.5 decades since we first started hearing about AIDS and what it was like here in Pittsburgh in those days, in the early 80s when we first started hearing about it, started seeing the first cases here in Pittsburgh. We're talking with Alan Jones, who is Pittsburgh AIDS Task Force, who was with the Pittsburgh AIDS Task Force, and someone who has worked as a caseworker in the areas of dealing with folks who have been infected by HIV/AIDS. Also with us, Dr. Charles Rinaldo, chairman and professor of the Department of Infectious Diseases and Microbiology at the University of Pittsburgh. We'd like to entertain your comments, your questions, and your stories. What you remember about those days, if there's something particularly inspiring that you would like to share with us, or perhaps something tragic. Those are stories we need to hear about as well. 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Is there some lingering resentment, Alan, and maybe to some extent you can comment on this as well, Dr. Rinaldo, about how cases were handled, that if people could not have been saved, that in many ways their lives could have been made easier if we had maybe taken a more sensitive and informed approach to how AIDS was dealt with?
I know one thing that I started as a caseworker at the Pittsburgh AIDS Task Force as late as 1991, and I did that for 8 years. And it was amazing.
And it was still a very, you know, it was still in a crisis stage, really, in those days.
Oh, there were, you know, we had ACT, which, you know, the average lifespan for a client once diagnosed with AIDS in those days was 18 months. And I had clients as short as a week and as long as 2 years. I lost over 160 clients during that time. They were as young as 20. And I think what was so awful in the beginning was there just was no resources. That the process of even today of trying to get SSDI, disability, for a major health issue could take a year or two to clear up. And in those days, half of our clients, I would say well over half, died before they ever got the first disability check. So you have someone with no income, who's lost their house or apartment, had their car repossessed, oftentimes didn't feel comfortable living with their family.
Well, it's going through the trauma of being rejected by their friends and family, right?
Exactly. I mean, I had clients whose families would not visit them because they weren't sure of how this virus was spread, wouldn't let their children, like nephews and nieces, visit them. And then I found the lack of resources extremely difficult. For instance, a lot of times my clients would have the wasting syndrome, you know, experiencing great weight loss. I would do the MA waiver, trying to get them insure something to combat their weight loss. And sometimes it would take several months before the paperwork was actually cleared. Oftentimes
just
they
to pay for something like insure?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, and so it was just always a lot of process. And one thing I remember very clearly is a lot of my clients didn't have the money for medication or medical coverage. And I actually used to distribute medicine, such as AZT, to clients who didn't have the coverage from clients who were deceased. Their families had given me the medicine.
And by contrast, today, you can pretty much any drug that you might need, you can get, right?
Yes, even without insurance.
Dr. Rinaldo, why in those early days were there so many drugs? There were so many different drugs that came along, you know, in the fight against AIDS. And one of them that comes to mind from those early days is ribavirin, which was thought to be kind of a panacea at first, and then turned out to be ineffective. There were a lot of drugs like that. Why was that happening?
Well, the virus was only really confirmed. It was discovered by the French in 83, and then Gallo confirmed it in 84. And so then we knew what we were up against exactly, and then they could look and see, well, what kind of drugs would work against this form of a virus, this retrovirus? And they came up with the drugs that were available at the time. There was Compound Q and all these Suramin and all these drugs, which showed activity, as we call it, in vitro, in the test tube. They were antiviral against this virus in the test tube. And ribavirin was one of those that worked pretty well with cells when you infect these with the virus. But when you get into the human body, they turned out to be fairly toxic, and they didn't know which doses to use. And it was flying blind at the time. And ribavirin is still actively used against hepatitis C. It's in conjunction with interferon alpha. So it's still on the market and quite a useful drug, but it just didn't prove alone to be effective against HIV. It was pretty miserable, actually.
And were there people who came along, who tried to capitalize on this and were coming up with things that they knew were not going to work just to get people to part with their money and pay for them?
I think, again, I would ask Alan to join in from the streets, but from my perspective as a scientist, no, they were people that wanted to get their publication and show that drug X, Y, or Z had some effect because, they were looking for probably some financial interest in that as well. But they were doing it through the regular channels from my perspective. We weren't in the same flow of things as the street drugs at the time. Although some of our drugs are being sold on the street, Alan and I have talked about that, how we would get like even AZT, which was available in 87 and FDA approved by 1987 to be used and did extend life. I want to be clear about that, about 1 year, which back then was huge.
Yes.
It was huge. But it was fairly toxic, and the early stuff was used at too high a dose and all this stuff. We were pretty well flying blind at the time. You couldn't do these five-year controlled studies of several years and looking at like they do for different drug effects. People were too desperate at the time and wanted something now, and that was a lot of pressure on scientists at the time to get that through. And some of that probably resulted in some of these drugs going faster than they should have to the patient without really knowing the right dose to use and so forth.
Alan, what were you seeing?
What I was seeing was, when people are dying and when people know they're probably not going to live 1 or 2 years after being diagnosed, people become desperate. And what I just remember people having all sorts of ideas. Some people would actually stop taking their meds thinking it wasn't helping. Some people would take, they'd be at some workshop or seminar where a friend would tell them about something that they tried or something somebody told them at a workshop. And I mean, I knew people that would drink vinegar mixed with grape juice. Some guy was used doing an IV, actually putting vinegar into his body, just because people were absolutely desperate for anything to prolong their life.
You hate to, in hindsight, they say that the cliche that hindsight is 20/20, but looking back on it, who or what is to blame for the slow start, the lack of urgency in addressing this 35 years ago? Let's not be shy.
I think part of it is being gay in those days, there was a great deal of stigma about it. And initially, certainly the first five plus years of this disease, people thought of it as a gay man's disease. So I think it had been affecting the general population, certainly in the white world, to be blunt. It would have been a different reaction, back in 1983
sure.
or 85
sure.
than it was.
Yeah, Alan's got a good point, but drug companies go for the money, okay? They're going to go, and then they
right.
saw the horizon, and as the 80s went on, they saw this is not going to go away. There are cases across the world. They're not just gay men, there's the hemophilia cases and others that are occurring in other Africa and Haiti and all that, if you remember all that craziness at the time. So they saw the opportunity, but they just didn't have the tools at the time to really find the miracle drugs. And it took them – AZT was pretty quick, actually, 87, but it actually came along a couple years earlier, and they worked it up fairly quick to get it FDA approved and so forth. So they did, but – Yeah, Alan's right. There was a stigma from the government. Certainly, the funding of the research took 2 or 3 years to get off. I say we were funded in 83. We were one of the first ones funded. That's 2 years after this thing was discovered, all right? We're in the first NIH grants to fight AIDS. And then it was back into the mid-80s, they finally formed other forms of research to fight this. So they were relatively slow, I must say.
And what have we learned 35 years later? How do we put this in perspective? You know, there's been the whole Ebola crisis. It seems that there's, in many ways, the reactions, the lack of accurate information, the panic that some people felt mirrored what we went through with the start of the AIDS crisis, right? Is that fair? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think we have to put that in perspective. When Ebola a few months ago or late last year was coming out, Tony Fauci, head of the NIAID, brought forth the fact that of the total number of people that died of Ebola at the time, a couple thousand, that was how many are dying of AIDS in one day. And so to put it in perspective, Ebola was a major problem, but and the way it's spread and so forth is more fearful to people. But HIV is still a huge killer compared to that that virus.
Thousands dying still in around the world. It's still a pandemic at this point. It's been interesting to engage in this conversation, to look back, as it were, at what happened here in Pittsburgh 35 years ago when the AIDS crisis was new and quite frightening because we knew so little. Joining us to talk about it and look back has been Dr. Charles Rinaldo, chairman and professor at the Department of Infectious Diseases and Microbiology at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Rinaldo, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And also with us, Alan Jones of the Pittsburgh AIDS Task Force. Alan, good to have you back. Thank you for sharing your stories and perspective with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed our time today.
Coming up, we will talk with author Joyce Brabner about her graphic novel, Second Avenue Caper, which utilizes the comic genre to explore the early days of AIDS in America. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Second Avenue Caper is what author Joyce Brabner calls a gang of misfits caper she always wanted to write. It includes a group of socially outcast friends living in New York City in the early 1980s, just as HIV/AIDS is beginning to hit the city's gay communities. As his friends start dying from the virus, the main character, Ray, who is a healthcare worker, manages to make some connections to people who can help him and his friends smuggle experimental medications into the country from Mexico. The story contained within this graphic novel, or comic book if you will, deals with many facets of the HIV/AIDS crisis as it was beginning. I'm joined now in Studio A by the author, Joyce Brabner, an award-winning author of nonfiction comics about social issues. She frequently collaborated with her late husband, Harvey Pekar, on his American Splendor series, and she's in Pittsburgh for tomorrow's Pittsburgh Indie Comics Expo. She joins us in Studio A. Joyce Brabner, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Also with us is the veteran illustrator who worked on this book with Joyce, Mark Zingarelli. Mark, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Second Avenue Caper, Joyce, tells a really particular story from the early years of the AIDS crisis. Can you talk about the themes you address here?
Well, since I'm telling a story about real people and it's nonfiction, I don't, invent themes because I'm talking about what it is, but I can tell you what I thought about after I'd written the story. And I really think that this is it's about community. It's about activism. So much of this takes place around a kitchen table in my friend's apartment. And it's also about courage and tenacity because earlier, your guests were talking about the different drug trials that people went through trying to find a solution. My friends did exactly that. The drugs that they were bringing in to treat themselves, they're essentially practicing medicine without a license, varied from time to time. And it wasn't until there was a larger help available and healthcare was accessible, that they were able to take care of people properly.
And though these are true stories and real people, the themes are universal. I mean, there is within these people, I think the reader can relate to them and what they're feeling, the fear, the confusion, the myths, all of that, and this, you know, desperate search for something some drug that will treat this, and you talk about and address through the characters just those issues of you hear them talking about, you know, that kind of Russian roulette you're playing with the different drugs, mm-hmm. the experimental drugs that may or may not work or that worked for a while then stopped working.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's more going on in this book than just looking for pharmaceuticals. You get very up close and personal with my friends. My friend Ray, who's critically ill right now, no, it's not AIDS. Everybody always asks if that. Had a story that wasn't going to get told because my friends were involved in something illegal. The story started out when Ray was working in a hospital and he saw a patient became patient 24, who had something that confounded everybody and died very quickly. It was because Ray is a curious guy that he started reading. There's actually a magazine called the Journal of Morbidity that talks about, you know, what people are dying of on a week-to-week basis. And he took this back to a kitchen table where, you know, we'd all get together, have, you know, spaghetti dinners. And when they looked at – my friends looked at it, one of them said, you know, if this is what we think it is, then half of us will be dead in 5 years. So what happened at that table, I think, as soon as my friends realized what was going on, and they realized way before even the larger community did, was an intense desire to know everything. This is pre-internet. The internet would have changed this kind of activism tremendously had people had that rapid communications, the ability to just collect news stories. As it was phone call to phone call, getting doctors up in the middle of the night who would comment very much off the record on what was happening, what might help.
And the doctors are in many ways are the heroes in this story because they're doing things that are essentially illegal and that they could have lost their
– The doctors helped the heroes in this story. The real heroes are my friends who made space in their crowded New York apartments for people who didn't have the strength to walk up five flights of stairs. They're my friends who – you know, fed, cared, clothed with everybody. And we haven't really talked about how this happened. Before the epidemic, a very sleazy doctor, not a hero at all, approached my friend Ray in the cafeteria and said, hey, you know, I got my diploma in Guadalajara, Mexico. I know a lot of cool guys down there. I can get a whole lot of weed, but I don't have any friends to sell it to, and you've got a lot of friends. So Ray, who is also a playwright, and his lover Ben, who's now a well-known jazz musician, figured that this was the only arts grant that they were going to get as, you know, a gay avant-garde playwright and musician. And they had a little side business of selling pot to their friends. Eventually, however, two things happened. One of them was that they had a source of income to pay for the drugs and the treatment. And the way the pot was priced was if you are sick, you got it for free to deal with the nausea, the illness, the pain, the appetite suppression. But if you're partying, you paid 2-3 times what it was because everybody knew what was going on.
A markup to compensate for.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, this was not. You know, this was about taking care of people. Now, eventually, the sleazy doctor kind of moved his way up in organized crime.
Karma catches up with him in this story.
Well, karma catches up with him in real life, I mean. But what happened in Ray went to him and said, look, we know you've got this deal smuggling weed in and out of Mexico, And we have heard of a drug, ribavirin, the one you talked about earlier, mm-hmm. that has really promising results. We cannot get it in that country unless it's like on a per-person prescription. Maybe you can get enough for 3 months for one person. Ray had already flown down there with his Irish Catholic grandmother and some friends, and they'd smuggled as much out as they could past customs. They said, we want to do the real deal. So my friend did a favor for the mafia. I mean, this is the caper part. He did a favor.
That's the whole scene where he ends up going to the pizza parlor.
He did a favor for the mafia in order to have, he drove a van full of money. He said, there's so much money, it was like you're picking up clothes for the Goodwill. This is the way these guys were running. And he did this. And as a result, he got to use one of their specially fitted RVs. This is what makes it a caper. It's just like the A-Team. They have a van.
And it's great storytelling. For example, when they're crossing back over the border from Mexico with the van full of ribavirin, mm-hmm. I find myself holding my breath. Are they going to make it? Sure. I got totally caught up in it. Are the guards going to seize this? Are they going to stop them? How are they going to avoid going to jail? What's going to happen? And mm-hmm. so you found a way to these are people that you are likely to care about anyway, but in the way that the story is laid out, and I want to talk to Mark about his illustrations, but the way it's laid out and illustrated, it is as exciting as any comic book, if you'll forgive that term.
I don't apologize. I don't like graphic novel at all.
I'm glad to hear you say
no,
that.
No, I don't. As a matter of fact, people coming to the event, the Pittsburgh Expo, will have the opportunity to buy a T-shirt, which has a panel from this book that makes everything clear about graphic novels. In it, character Joyce looks at another character. The character says, okay, so Joyce, what's the difference between a comic book and a graphic novel? And my younger self says, well, one is spaghetti, maybe SpaghettiOs, and the other one is pasta. So that's on a T-shirt. Come on down and see it, and I will explain it better. But I just say big fat real life comic.
And that's what I felt like. Sure. I was reading. And it was as good as Iron Man or the Flash or anything.
Let's just
else
say
I've
it was
read.
As good as American Splendor and other.
Oh, there
other,
we go.
There
well,
you go.
We need to talk about Harvey here at some point. But Mark, talk about what it was like to illustrate the people in this story, real people. And in particular, were there any concerns about, not making the characters out to be queer caricatures?
Well, the characters themselves were well-defined by Joyce. I mean, if I had questions about – of course, there are – the only person in the book that looks like who they are is Ray. The other people's faces had to be changed because – we're not using their names for obvious reasons. But Joyce and Ray define the characters pretty well. I would have a few questions about this character or that character or an incident. And so I was on the phone with Ray quite a bit during the production of the book. There were things that he was concerned with, as a gay man, and there were also things about this being a comic book, it's not a novel. It's not Dostoevsky. So we didn't have a lot of room to define characters. So sometimes, in comics, you have to take some shortcuts. And he was worried in some cases that those shortcuts people would get the wrong impression about the character. But I think the general response to the characters and the way they were written and drawn is that people – I haven't heard anyone say, this is a stereotype.
That didn't come up at all, and that wasn't my concern. Part of it's because the reason I asked Mark to do this is that Mark doesn't think of people as caricatures. He's from the time. He remembered the time. We have certainly got plenty of gay friends and family members and – when you're in a cultural worker, you're certainly going to rub shoulders with more, more people who are out in the open because the arts are more open and accepting to gay, lesbian, queer, transgendered people. And it was never a question of doing a queer caricature. The question was doing a real-life, real-looking person, not something glossed over like Superman with his blue forelock or Batman in his square chin.
Right. And of course, you know, the tragedy and there's you know, comic books in many ways are – the stories are like opera. You know, there's all mm-hmm. this emotional turmoil going on. In your case, Mark, you are having to illustrate people, real people who are dying. Talk about the challenge of doing that and just, I guess, emotionally for you as an artist to have to lay these images out for people.
Well, at this point, it's no secret that halfway through the book, I lost the muse. It wasn't because it was a depressing thing, but it was there were a lot of factors in that. Joyce had to come to my house one night and from Cleveland to Pittsburgh and give me the
– I waited outside until I saw him in and I knocked, banged on the door and said, "You out now. Do not quit." And we can't quit because there's a question as whether Ray was going to be alive to see the publication of the book.
And that
was
that point right there that Joyce made really was one of the turning points for me. I've been on the phone with Ray quite a bit during the creation of the characters. I would run roughs past him. Is this kind of how – does this work for you? You know, Joyce mm-hmm. was pleased with everything. But Ray would call me with concerns. So how are you going to draw this? How are you going to draw my mom?
But that's – but the thing, to be absolutely fair, Ray knew about comics only in that he would read my work or Harvey's work, but he didn't really read comics in general. So he had certain prejudices. Now, Ray was a playwright. But he was concerned, and this is consistent with everybody else that I do nonfiction comics about tough issues. I have had people complain that I had a hip hop artist doing a story about young black kids who formed an organization called Survived in Da Hood. Well, when he drew people wearing beads in their hair and kente cloth and other Afrocentric stuff, the very uptight Bill Cosby, before he became notorious for being a sex fiend, people, you know, the Bill Cosby in a sweater people looked at this and said, those are hair curlers. That is a bathrobe. The kente cloth was a bathrobe. People have been drawn with big lips, with butts. And all the Afro-American kids who are Afrocentric hip-hop said, yes, this is the way we look. And the other group wanted Barbie and Ken dipped in chocolate. So you get this a lot. I did a story in which a woman died terribly. She was a victim of a bombing in Central America. Her husband was really afraid that her kid would I made sure that this comic book went to the family way before it came out because I thought – I knew there was a young man, like a teenage son, who might have seen this and found out some things about his mother's death that the family hadn't really told him. And the husband said, this is journalism. This is absolutely correct all the way. This is actually what happened. I just wish I didn't have to see it because it's my family. So, yeah – people get a little queasy about comics, and that's a whole other conversation.
We're talking with Joyce Brabner, who, again, is an award-winning author of nonfiction comics about social issues and also the man that she collaborated with on her very fine graphic novel or comic book, Second Avenue Caper, the illustrator Mark Zingarelli, who is also with us. Man, we're running out of time, so there's some things I wanted to get to. You know, I wanted to talk about Harvey because, you know, so many of us are enamored with him and his work, and many of us came to know and love him from the David Letterman show and all those appearances. What did you learn from working with him, living with him? He was such a creative force. Harvey Pekar, we're talking about.
I learned patience because he was a difficult person.
No kidding.
And he was a wonderful person. Mark actually had a chance to work with him, but he was challenging, and you know, we were a really good match. We both matched in terms of intellect. We both matched in terms of creativity. Our attitudes about money, art, you know, we wanted more art than money. The whole business about being famous was merely an instrument to be able to work the next day. That's just what you had to do. So that is what I picked up. In terms of working in comics, I'd come to comics having worked in theater as a playwright and doing other kinds of writing. And I think the biggest thing that I learned from him was to not embellish, to really bring out the finer details, even if it made the story wasn't slick. It didn't have a slick beginning or an end. My writing style is still a little bit different than his because he'd had a lot of stories where he just sort of walked off the page, you know, into nowhere. Mm-hmm. And Mark, Mark's laughing.
Well, I've
drawn
some of those.
Now you collaborate with him. You'd say, what did you learn from working with Harvey?
I learned how to interpret stick figures with word balloons into actual images.
I'm getting the signal to wrap up. I want to finish this by saying, young people in particular, know so little about history, and there are many people walking around on this planet today who have no idea just how horrific the early days of the AIDS crisis were. Is this how you reach people now? Is this where you meet them? Is at the comic book level? And I don't.
I meet people in any way. You're making it sound as though comics about comic books are different. Comics are a means, a method.
But
of communication.
It is different. Yeah. I mean, it is different.
Well, it is, but it's a back pocket documentary. I'm just finished.
Sure. That's a great way of putting it.
I'm finished at the point where somebody else has to go rent a crane for a tracking shot, and I can just say to Mark, this is what I want. I want a bird's eye view.
Well, it's been a fascinating conversation, and it is a great book. It was a pleasure to read Second Avenue Caper. We've been talking with the author, Joyce Brabner, also the illustrator, Mark Zingarelli. Thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, we will talk about the Three Rivers Heritage Trail, a survey that was done that tells us about our riverfronts. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The Three Rivers Heritage Trail offers 24 miles of scenic trailway for walkers and bikers and has become recognized as a major landmark in the recent revitalization of Pittsburgh's riverfronts. Today marks the release of the trail's first ever user survey and economic impact study, which testifies to the trail's impact on users, local communities, and the economy. Joining us to talk about the report and what it tells us about the state of our riverfronts are Tom Baxter, Executive Director of Friends of the Riverfront, which built and maintains the trail, and Carl Nock, who is Trail Development Manager with the Rails to Trails Conservancy. Tom and Carl, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
A new survey on the trails is being released today. Tell us about some of the findings documented in the survey.
Well, one of the most important things is that we put counters out on the trail so we could get an estimate about how many people use the trail on an annual basis. And that number came in somewhere a little over 800,000 annual user visits, which is a tremendous testament to the work that Tom and Friends of the Riverfront have done in terms of building out this trail network. The other thing that's most important is that we wanted to see what the economics are. And the economics of this particular trail are substantial, coming to almost $8.3 million. Almost $6 million of that actually is in what we call consumable goods, which means that people are using the trail and then stopping in a restaurant or an ice cream shop or buying some services along the way, renting a bike, that sort of thing. And that's really a very high number. But that's the kind of thing I would almost expect in a fairly urban environment such as Pittsburgh, because there are lots of places for people to buy things. We've done some other studies on rural trails where there may be 10 miles between one restaurant and another. But Pittsburgh has a wealth of opportunities for people to go out and spend some money while enjoying the trails.
And what about the trail's impact on not just the people who use it, but the communities that it runs through? How has it impacted communities?
Well, we have, of course, the city of Pittsburgh, but we're also working very hard to link and develop the Three Rivers Heritage Trail throughout Allegheny County. We're working to connect further beyond Millvale as part of the Erie to Pittsburgh Trail. We now have a completed Great Allegheny Passage, and we're working really hard to connect to the Montour Trail via some Ohio communities.
How are the riverfront trails in Pittsburgh being used? Who is using them?
Well, it's an interesting dynamic in that of all the studies we've done, and we've done about a dozen studies on different trails in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, the users of the Pittsburgh Trail are slightly younger than what we found other places. There's a large segment of the population between the ages, you know, almost a quarter of the users are between the ages of 26 and 35. So they're millennials who like to live in an urban environment. And then the next largest percentage, which is what we typically see, are people that are basically over 45. And they're people who may be retired, have some extra time. They find bicycling and walking on a trail that's fairly level is a great way to get exercise and stay healthy.
And what are some of the good things that you're hearing from people about this? That obviously there are quite a few who are happy with it and are using it.
Oh, they love it. And one thing we hear a lot more of now is we want more trails. And that's a very good problem to have. And it's great that we're really working hard with other partners to continue this development to help other riverfront communities.
And what else are people looking for just in terms of improvements and that kind of thing?
Well, I think most the one thing that people say most, we want more bathrooms. And that's consistent whether it's the Three Rivers Heritage Trail or a trail in any other community. That always comes up high on the list. We want bathrooms, water fountains, things that are, you know, normal infrastructure, but just very difficult to manage in a trail environment.
So people aren't just necessarily saying, hey, I'm out in the middle of nature, I can just use what's at my disposal. They want the facilities.
Absolutely.
What is planned for the future of the Three Rivers Heritage Trail?
Well, we work with over 50 events every year, and a tremendous amount of volunteer hours go in, over 5,000 hours to help monitor and maintain. Moving forward, we're going to continue working on developing, creating additional connections.
Tomorrow is National Opening Day for trails. What's planned to mark the occasion here in Pittsburgh, gentlemen?
Well, we are hosting a volunteer event on the south side section of the Three Rivers Heritage Trail. People are welcome to come out. We take care of all the details, and right now we're planting a few trees that were damaged by beavers and, you know, giving the trail a really good once over before the really tremendous amount of people start coming out.
Yeah, and when is that? When do they start coming out in earnest?
Well, one of the things we found from the survey, people use the trail year-round, but in the warmer months, people will have a much higher increased usage of the trail, especially during lunch.
And it's a variety of uses, right?
Oh, yeah. We found that biking and walking are the two largest in terms of percentage, with 44% of the people said they bike on the trail, 32.7% say walk. But also running's very high. Again, it's an indication of that dynamic. There's 26 to 35-year-old millennials who haven't lost their knees like I have.
But people who are older can still, you know, do things that are lower impact, like cross-country ski. Is that being done in the wintertime?
Yes, that is, in particular on the Southside Trail. We still have people that do cross-country skiing. And I'd like to stress that
that's really what makes it a year-round thing, isn't it?
Oh, and bird watching was really high up there. People go out there for nature. That's why we work so hard to restore these riverfronts, plant all the trees, and make sure that it's a real good experience for everybody.
Well, it sounds like there are a lot of people enjoying it, and that there will be improvements that will continue to be made. And tomorrow, again, is National Opening Day for trails. So anything else happening as part of the celebration quickly?
Yeah, I think it's part of the celebration. Tom talked about the stewardship event that starts at 10 o'clock at 4th Street, and then there'll be a bike ride from noon till 2, guided by Friends of the Riverfront. And then a pizza party to follow.
Nice. Recarb or replenish those carbohydrates that you've burned up from biking on the trail. It's the Three Rivers Heritage Trail, and it offers 24 miles of scenic trailway for walkers, bikers, and people who like to get exercise. Thanks to Carl Nock and also Tom Baxter, for joining us to talk about it. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Have a great weekend, everybody.